As material science can regard only weights and measures, concepts of time and space, volume and degrees of speed as the foundations for a real science, it cannot, with this attitude, include the thought world, or the fourth principle of matter, under what it perceives as science. A thought cannot be weighed or measured in meters, liters or kilos. And even in such cases where one might really succeed, through a suitable measuring device, in ascertaining a reaction of thought, this discovery would only be an experience of the outer material effects of the kind of energy of the thought, that is, a new experience of degrees of vibration or speed. But the real nature or innermost being of a thought would still remain an enigma, would still be a mystery. That one can ascertain the thought as a kind of electric vibration, force or movement does not of course remove the mystery and cannot possibly be a satisfactory answer to the question about its innermost analysis. The fact that the thought is an electrical vibration or wavelength, or the like, does not of course explain how it comes about that it is perceived as desire, will, joy or sorrow. To register the reactions to these occurrences in the brain as degrees of vibration or wavelength is only an experience of new numerical results. This experience can create with this only a further extension of the already existing ocean of numbers and results in weights and measures of material science. Chapter 3, There is more between heaven and earth than stone, water and air. As the thought world is the experience of life itself, indeed is life itself, it cannot be expressed in weights and measures, in degrees of vibrations or wavelengths, for such results are no more than dead or lifeless phenomena. They do not explain what or who that something is that perceives the thought as desire and will, as sorrow and joy, that something that desires the solving of the mystery of thought, that something that explains matter in terms of weights and measures. Can a stone, can water or air, or a combination of any of the physical ingredients of these substances, think, desire, will, speak and act, feel joy and sorrow, pleasantness or unpleasantness? As long as it is a fact that there is something in existence that can sense, desire, speak and act, feel hunger and satiation, feel joy and sorrow, it is also a fact that there is more between heaven and earth than just stone, water, and air, and that everyone who denies this denies facts and is, in this particular area, still only a layman. Such a being is still, in the area of the study of life itself, quite an inept being to whom tribute is paid in superstition, whether he be a professor, a doctor or in any other way a representative of a wide material study. Chapter 4, When one has abandoned living facts to live on dead ones. We see here that something is missing in the modern world. Having abandoned belief in the teachings and dogmas of the religions and having gone over to replacing these with scientific results in weights and measures, one has abandoned living facts to live on dead ones. That this is true becomes a fact through the circumstance that mankind today finds itself in the middle of a desperate and apparently hopeless struggle for its existence, in the middle of its abundance of material knowledge and ability, in the midst of its extraordinarily advanced, enormously powerful machines by means of which it produces useful objects by the thousand, clothing, light and warmth as well as a profusion of foodstuffs more than sufficient to abundantly cover terrestrial mankind's consumption. And with whom then is it that mankind is engaged in a dangerous struggle? Indeed, it is, however incredible it may sound, exclusively with itself. In its spiritual blindness it mobilizes its entire material knowledge and ability in favor of the killing principle. And with the most ingeniously devised murder techniques it brings about a mass stabbing of its own body, collective mankind. In addition to the fact that it sabotages and shatters a mass of the ingenious cultural amenities and expressions of humaneness, which it has itself previously built up, it tortures, mutilates and murders by the million its own life cells, which means those individuals or people of whom it consists, at the same time as it turns great and fertile areas into battlefields, into terrains of death, into deserts, and huge metropolises into heaps of ruins. Chapter 5, Solutions in terms of weights and measures cannot be an adequate basis for true happiness. How will mankind as a whole become fit and healthy? How will it, as an entity, be able to flourish? How will it be possible to build up a lasting peace on the basis of the above-mentioned methods and principles? Is it not here obvious that something is lacking? Is it not equally obvious that the ocean of results and solutions in terms of weights and measures of materialistic science is not adequate for the creation of mankind's true happiness? Is it not evident that the understanding of terrestrial mankind's true well-being does not yet have anything to do with real science? Is it not a fact that one lives in the illusion or under the superstition that one can create lasting peace through maintaining a permanent state of war? One perfects one's knowledge of murdering, mutilating and destroying, and to this end manufactures the most ingenious technical instruments and machines, and does not understand at all that the effect of all these war machines is only an attack against matter. Admittedly, they are aimed at mankind's own flesh and blood bodies, but what are flesh and blood? Are they anything other than stone, water and air? The war machines do not affect, and will never be able to affect, the very cause of war, which is not to be found either in stone, water or air, but exclusively in thought. Of what use is it that so many cultural centers are laid waste, that so many millions of people are killed and mutilated, or that so many standing armies and navies are levied as a defense? They do not remove the true cause of war itself, which, as already mentioned, is not to be found in the stone, the water or the air and cannot therefore be found in flesh or blood either, but exclusively in the world that materialistic science denies, namely the spiritual world. Chapter 6, The True Cause of Mankind's Present Misfortune. It is thus not mankind's material world, its heaven and earth, bodies, eyes, ears, lung and heart function that there is something wrong with, but its thought world. Mankind's ability to think has thus not acquired its science as has its material world. It is this circumstance that is the cause of all war and bloodshed, quite apart from the fact that it is also in the thought world that the cause of all mankind's other ills, sorrows and problems are rooted. The true cause of mankind's present misfortune is the fact that it lives in two worlds but recognizes only one of them, namely the physical. Mankind is, as previously mentioned, highly scientifically conscious in this world, while denying, to an overwhelming extent, the other world, namely the spiritual, as a reality. It is this denial for which, under all circumstances without exception, each of its sources will pay dearly and that makes every true happiness for a society of such sources impossible. The lasting peace that mankind desires and waits for with such longing will thus never be able to exist in a world with the mental attitude towards, or the ignoring of, the plane of thought, the spiritual world, shown by terrestrial mankind. The road towards peace goes exclusively through making the thought world of the beings a science, so that they become just as much at home in this so-called abstract world as they are now at home in the concrete physical world. Terrestrial human beings cannot continue recognizing the real world directly surrounding their eye as simply an abstract or imaginary world. It must become just as concrete or realistic as the physical world. Chapter 7, Only a real science of thought or spiritual science can re-establish mankind's mental or spiritual stability. Someone will perhaps object here that no one is so unfamiliar with the thought world as suggested above. Indeed, one can even, through authorized science, be trained as a psychologist, that is, an expert in everything that concerns the living being's psyche or soul. In addition to this, there is of course also the philosophical training within the same science. But what do these authorized psychologists and philosophers know? How much insight into the mystery of human mental life or into the solution of the mystery of life itself have we, through the authorized academic training, been able to give such beings? Indeed, here one must keep in mind that this aspect of authorized science is still in its very first, weak beginnings. And even if it can now begin to be of some use within certain superficial branches of terrestrial human mental life, it is still nothing positive that can undermine materialistic science's denial of, and attitude contrary to, the existence of the real spiritual world. This branch of authorized science cannot therefore possibly bring mankind into the real, perfect, intimate relation to its thought world or mental world, that is necessary in order to abolish war in the inner world of the individuals as well as in their relation to the outer world, their surroundings and neighbors. Authorized materialistic science will not therefore be able to replace the loss of the fundamental security, spiritual stability or peace of mind that people, with the loss of their religious ability to believe and the thereby broken intimacy in their concept of God or relation to Providence, have lost. Terrestrial mankind's real and absolute hope in its present culminating state of darkness can therefore only be the creation of a real, concrete science of the area of intellectual or mental life. People must become familiar with the mental or spiritual structure of the living being and the eternal laws of life, not as something abstract, but as a real scientific reality in awake, day-conscious analysis. Such a science is spiritual science. Part 2. Communism and Democracy. Chapter 8. What Science Is. Real spiritual science is not yet something that can be studied in depth at the universities and colleges of the nations. But this does not prevent spiritual science from being science. Real science is a description of realistic facts or experiences. And it cannot be denied that such can come into existence without the authorization of universities and professors. A fact is science regardless of whether a layman or a professor has experienced it. Spiritual science is a series of experiences or facts that have not been experienced by materialistic science and cannot possibly be experienced by it. The former science cannot therefore count on acceptance from materialistic science. But this, of course, does not prevent spiritual science from being fact and thereby science. Chapter 9. Mankind finds itself in a crash dive towards dictatorship. Philosophical systems or points of view have not been able to give people the mental insight necessary to prevent the tremendous crash dive towards totalitarianism or dictatorship in which all states today find themselves, regardless of what they at the moment call this dive or their physical or mental fate, regardless of whether they call their condition democracy or communism. Both these ideas began in their time as excellent theoretical ideal systems but did not have a very long lifetime because of an invisible force of which people have not yet become aware. This force inevitably compels all political systems of today, both in the West and in the East, whether in the South or in the North, deeper and deeper into dictatorship. Dictatorship deprives mankind of its freedom. This deprivation creates hatred and the desire for liberation from the yoke. It creates tendencies of rebellion against the system. This in turn compels the dictatorship or those in power to maintain growing secret and open police forces, greater and greater bodyguards, which must make so many arrests that the ordinary prisons do not suffice. One must therefore make use of the so-called concentration camps, that is, barrack towns with barbed wire fences, watchtowers, armed guards, torture and gas chambers and other sadistic contraptions to such a degree that here all hope is abandoned for the unfortunates who, in their rightful demand for freedom, have ended up here. Indeed, these concentration camps have long since been revealed as pure mental and physical cancerous tumors in terrestrial mankind's physical structure, arousing all the most appalling, sadistic tendencies in those individuals who are the executioners and slave drivers of these terrains of hell. It is foolish to believe that not all countries or states today are in an enormous landslide towards this sadistic hell, which must end with the wiping out of all culture from the face of the earth if people do not steer their democracy and communism of today away from the glaringly false course by which they, in their intellectual blindness throughout the last decades, have begun to swear. Chapter 10. What true democracy and true communism cannot be, and what they are. Democracy and communism cannot be the ruthless persecution and enslavement of the individual by the state, and the ensuing development of a tyrannizing, hideous lust for power in some self-appointed ruling clique and its henchmen. Democracy and communism cannot be the maintenance of a state by means of all sorts of modern gangster methods with merciless, ruthless and extortionate taxation, a sudden disregard of all private property, creating such a flood of restrictions that the individual can no longer buy so much as a sock or a shirt without the permission of the dictatorship. Neither can it be democracy or communism to maintain a political or state structure that is a heavy, destructive yoke upon every personal initiative and talent, in the form of a ruthless, restraining deprivation of its fruits. Democracy and communism cannot be state structures that are tyrannies against which the individual has absolutely no protection. Likewise, democracy and communism cannot be structures compelling everyone to be informers or still pigeons in order to save their own skins. How can a lasting peace become a reality within a system that is the ultimate breeding place for all the lowest animal natures in man? It is not so strange that people's political structures of today are neither true democracy nor true communism. These two political concepts can constitute only one and the same thing, namely an all-encompassing lasting world peace. What is not real peace cannot possibly be democracy or communism. True democracy and communism can only be a state structure, a political system that guarantees the individual his full personal freedom and all the fruits of his talents or useful creations. It is a system that protects the individual against every tyranny and abuse from other beings. It is a system whose foremost task is to find out what talents are hidden in every citizen coming into the world, in order so to guarantee that citizen the highest development or training of those talents, knowing that only in this way will the individual be the highest joy and blessing for himself and the state. It is thus a system based on human abilities and talents instead of money and gold. It is a system based on the knowledge that the state consists of individuals, and that the higher the talents and abilities of these individuals can be raised, the greater perfection in spirit and culture and the greater blessing for citizens will the emergence of the same state be. Chapter 11. How democracy and communism have become the opposite of what they were intended to be. Real democracy and communism are thus exactly the opposite of the existing political systems of today the world over. Today the government of each state has become a power group with a more or less open or camouflaged dictatorial authority and expression, while the mass of citizens to a corresponding degree are enslaved in a more or less open or camouflaged way by the above-mentioned power group. Against this power group the individual is quite unprotected in ratio to the dictatorial authority of this group. That such political systems do not constitute peace but war is a matter of course. The fact that the right to vote or freedom of choice exists within the so-called democratic countries has not resulted in securing a form of government that could remove the dictatorial restrictions, injunctions, encroachments on private property and financial circumstances that have become prevalent in all countries. It has likewise become evident that trade union movements, employers' unions, strikes and lockouts have also been unable to create peace within society. Wage increases and price rises have become an endless spiral that in no way whatsoever guarantees security for its originators. Everything within the democratic states runs counter to democracy, just as everything within the communist states runs counter to real communism. Are there not in the communist countries the same class differences as in the democratic states? Are there not here an upper class and a lower class, a nobility and a proletariat, which can be compared with the class differences that existed under the kings of the great absolute monarchies? Neither democracy nor communism are any longer the elevated ideals they were intended to be from the start. This is why the prevailing political structures of today from idealistic beginnings have gradually, as previously mentioned, ended up in a crash dive towards an abyss, a dive towards war and mutilation, a dive towards a total cessation of real cultural manifestation or creation, a dive towards the doomsday that has already begun to ruin the most efficient dictatorial states and has brought their relentless dictators to a degrading death or annihilation in the form of murder and suicide, and their henchmen to death on the scaffold as war criminals. Chapter 12, How Dictatorship Defeats Both Religion and Materialistic Science. One must not believe that the same fate will not overcome other totalitarian systems and their originators if a change in their attitude to the advantage of true democracy or true communism does not set in. However, quite apart from this, it cannot be denied that evolution is advancing quickly. The choking octopus tentacles of the principle of dictatorship with their suckers are, at this moment, clasping all states and individuals without one really wanting to admit this truth. For these suckers present themselves as innocent, unavoidable, emergency measures such as import bulges, shortage of goods, price rises, wage struggles, strikes, lockouts and unemployment. These deadly suckers in turn force the governments, regardless of whether they are democratic or communist, into dictatorial measures as regards access to accommodation, heating, light and clothing, to transport, to permission to travel abroad, to the sale and purchase of goods. In addition to this, there is the enormous consumption of the state's money for the dictatorial levying of military forces, for a preferably supreme army and navy complete with an expensive air force. Sighing and groaning under this dictatorial yoke, which the public has been induced to believe to be true democracy or true communism, this condition gives rise to a strengthened fresh outbreak of nationalism or the worship of one's own nation at the expense of other nations. And with this weakened confidence in, or deluded attitude to, true democracy, the path is more or less clear for the onward march of total dictatorship. Censorship of speech, thought and spirit begins to cut off the last remains of personal freedom. The dictatorship becomes complete. And this entire development of dictatorship is flourishing not least within the Christian states and is practiced to a great extent by beings who are baptized in the name of the Father, the Son and the Holy Spirit. It is true that this development was never wanted and in reality is not wanted by people today either, where they are not being mesmerized by inflammatory propaganda in favor of dictatorship. It is something that takes place despite people's striving to create democracy or communism. It is something that religious as well as political powers, like material science, have not yet been able to remedy. Chapter 13, No National Government Whatsoever Can Remedy the Misery. A government in an individual country can easily prove its innocence and helplessness in the face of the advancing evolution of dictatorship. It cannot help it if some of the other states do not want to open up any superfluous supplies of fuel, oil, cereals or other essential products they might have, except under terms that are difficult or insurmountable. Such a government has therefore no other course but to order the citizens of its own country to restrict their consumption of the necessities of life to the limited quantities to which there is access through the country's own modest currency and ability to provide for itself. That this restriction can take place only through dictatorship, rationing, goods control and so on is a matter of course. That enormous inroads into the personal freedom and private property of the citizens are hereby made in the form of restrictions that are glaringly against democratic policy in the protection of citizens, which have been enforced during a certain period of time, is a matter of course. It was in this period that the current colossal scientific, technical and chemical advances were made that must now stagnate because of the severe policy of nationalization and exaggerated worship of one's native country behind gigantic barriers of growing military forces within which the national states are each isolating themselves. That this isolation or encapsulation of the national states must become a calcification of or obstruction to international communication between the states, which has gradually become a condition of life, may well be assumed to be evident as an unshakable fact. That this calcification cannot be cured by an even more effective policy of isolation or encapsulation of the national state in the form of an even greater worship of the native country and violent military forces can only be just as much a matter of course. That the body of the collective international terrestrial human society will react violently against this deadly calcification within itself is only what has become an unshakable fact through the world war that began in 1914 and that can only be stopped on the day when an international, democratic legal and judicial system, equipped with the power to break down all national military isolations and deadly idolizations of each native country, arises. Until then, the nationalizations will be able only to offer their populations restrictions, deprivation of freedom or depressing encroachments in all imaginable fields. Chapter 14, The Delusion of the Great Majority. It is natural that the masses in their ignorance and disappointment will react in a revolutionary way against this crash dive towards the abyss, against the deprivation of freedom and the lower standard of living that their governments, out of vital necessity, must maintain. The great masses believe that it is only a matter of trade organizations and wage rises, and join political parties that, to a particular degree, have as their aim the prosecution of private initiative or undertakings, in favor of state takeovers of all production, and do not understand at all that this change is not a solution even if it, sometime in the future when mankind in another way has matured enough for this, will take place. They do not understand either that all the difficulties will be the same under any national government whatsoever, no matter which one is in power. Dictatorship will still to a greater or lesser extent prevail. The crash dive towards cultural breakdown or deprivation of freedom that people within the democratic countries of today are subject to, and under which the citizens in the totalitarian states already groan, and that has laid so many of the cultural centers of Europe in ruins and sent millions of people to torture, invalidity, slavery and gas chambers, cannot be stopped by strikes or lockouts, wars, treaties or agreements of any kind whatsoever. Price rises or wage increases do not count either in this great play. The misery, as we previously touched upon, does not at all originate in effects to which these measures can, in any way whatsoever, be an antidote. On the contrary, these measures can only make the evil even worse. Chapter 15, What People Must Do in the First Place. People's great material knowledge, their mastery of the forces of nature or the elements and their elevated materialistic science have not been able to prevent this, their fall towards the abyss, towards deprivation of all personal liberty, towards bondage and enslavement, towards poverty, starvation and disease, towards hopelessness and depression. This is today a fundamental fact for any researcher whatsoever who can really think, hear and see. What then should people do about this dismal fact before it is too late? The first condition is of course that, instead of striving to set the spiral of price rises whirling at full speed, they must stop, read, listen and think. Their entire experience of darkness, their yoke of war, bondage and loss of liberty of course create feelings or sensations of life that show that people in themselves are something quite other than stone, water and air, and that there is more between heaven and earth than just matter. But why then believe that one can live without having any knowledge of this something that is not stone, water or air, this something that is not flesh, blood or the senses but on the contrary constitutes the something that experiences darkness or misery through the senses? Since this misery or mankind's mental crisis is a fact, it is also a fact that there is something that experiences this crisis, something that weeps, suffers ill health and is unhappy about its dark fate. Can stone, water or air weep about their fate? Can these phenomena have a fate at all? Do they not wander in a law-bound cycle? Must not stone melt, water evaporate and air liquefy under certain changes of temperature? Matter can neither laugh nor cry over its condition. Does one not think it is about time that one began to understand that the ability to feel suffering and happiness is in itself a revelation of something that is beyond matter, and for which matter exists only as material for the experience of life? And does one not think that this something can just as well use matter as material for the creation of happiness as it can use it as material for the creation of misfortune and depression? Chapter 16, Mankind's salvation is not a problem of goods or money but a psychic problem. Is it not glaringly wrong to maintain an administration of state within which intellectual people, who in many respects are already geniuses, should be chased around like a flock of dumb animals, like a flock of sheep or geese, by a dominant slave driver or a group of slave drivers who, through their mental structure and behavior, reveal themselves as intellectual or spiritual non-entities? Beings who publicly, by word or action, reveal that they would rather live one day as a lion than 100 days as a lamb, have unshakably revealed themselves as mental non-entities or retarded people on a plane where one creates humanity, culture, peace and happiness. Is it not a fact that such a being belongs among the wild scalp or headhunters? That intellectual mankind has sunk, in certain cases, to allowing such scalp and headhunters, either as individual dictators or as dictatorial power groups, to do as they like with its life, soul and spirit, must invariably lead to a culturally destructive epoch of death like that under which the same mankind of today in wide areas moans, sighs and groans.